Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 72 for May 2016. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a regular episode where we go over the stuff that has been happening in our home countries, mostly. Some of us are from multiple countries, so we might hear from different places. And my name is Patrick Beja, and we're going to be talking about the things that happened in the past month. We're in end of May, so you'll get a panorama of world information and hopefully a little bit of entertainment over the next maybe hour and a half. And I said maybe a little bit of entertainment, but I'm pretty sure we're going to have some very entertaining moments because Turkey is back. Yay, Turkey!
Hey, Patrick. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. You've been traveling around. You've been everywhere. And I have gotten comments, like at least two, maybe three even, that said, "Where is Turkey? We miss Turkey." And you know what I answered?
Yeah.
I answered, "I miss him too." Aww.
Aww. So sweet of you. Well, I was busy. You were in Japan. I was in Hong Kong. You were in Japan. I was in Bali, Indonesia. And yeah. Hopefully I'll be in Japan in September, and you'll be in Paris.
In September I'll be in Paris. Yeah, I'm going in
June.
You'll be in
Paris? Yeah. All right.
Yeah, so you're basically, you avoided Japan until I had left. So, but it's okay. I can give you tips about where to go and what to do. It's fine.
Well, I just figured it'll be safer without you there.
Well, given how safe it is, yes, I'm probably a dangerous factor in society, you know. I do things that the Japanese don't approve of. Like, I don't know, I was going to say throw papers in the street, like tissues, but I don't do that because the streets are so clean. You feel very self-conscious about
stuff.
You
kiss in public.
Yes, exactly. That is dangerous. We do kiss in public. All right. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you had fun during your vacation and your travels. Apparently, you did.
I had a wonderful time in Hong Kong. Met Paul and his lovely wife, which was great.
Excellent. You'll have to tell me about that next time we hang out. We also have other people that are first comers on the show. So please, a warm welcome to Bart, who is actually, so you're originally Belgian, but you're now in Ireland, as exemplified by your lovely accent. Hey, Bart.
Yes, good morning. Yes, it was a long time ago when I was in Belgium, and my parents put me in an Irish school without teaching me English first.
Nice.
So that's a really good way not to get an accent. just drop the kid off in school and leave. It'll be fine.
They were like, "All right, you hang out, just figure it out. You'll be fine."
Apparently, it didn't take me long. Apparently, it only took me a few weeks, and I was speaking like a local.
So. How old were you?
4. I think when you're young, I think your brain can do that. I think if you try that with me now, I don't think it'd work anymore.
All right, cool. So you were 4 and you've been living in Ireland for how long? Do you feel more Irish or Belgian?
I still actually feel quite strongly both identities, because all of my family, with very few exceptions, live over in Belgium. So although I don't spend a large percentage of my time there, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to people there, and I still feel both. And when you have to spell your name every time you say it, you don't really feel a local, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah, yeah. I have to admit, when I'm in Japan, I'm like, "Oh, it's Beja," and they're like, "What?" And yeah, it doesn't help for sure.
I've gotten good with the phonetic alphabet. That's my solution to these things.
Lastly, Franco is here. So he is now in Spain, but originally from Peru. So you're basically the entire, because, you know, Peru is going to be the entirety of Latin America. So you're the entirety of the Spanish-speaking world for us today on the Feliz Club. Hope, no pressure. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, I feel a lot of responsibility. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. How long have you been in Spain?
It's been a little bit over 6 years right now.
All right. So same question. Do you feel Spanish or no? Go ahead. I won't interrupt you.
I was going to say I didn't have a language issue as Bart did. Because it's so easy to change countries along Hispanic countries, I guess.
But didn't you say things that they didn't understand at first, or did you have like weird idioms and expressions that they looked at you like, what?
That keeps going on. I think I'm unable to get the whole accent right. So, but I have now a mixture of both. So whenever I go to Peru, they think I'm Spaniard, and whenever I'm in Spain, they think I'm Latin American because they don't make a distinction among countries.
You're right. So. That's actually pretty interesting. Is it the case that the Spanish actually don't, you know, differentiate too much between Latin American countries, or?
That's totally that way. For example, in Latin America, you hear Argentinians speaking, and they talk a different, completely different accent, but completely different. And then they tell me that I'm Argentinian, which doesn't make sense if they just listen to the words I say, but. I don't have a problem. I mean, it's just funny.
Right. Okay. All right. Cool. So we have a great panel together, and I guess I'm going to start with what's been happening in France and a little bit of Finland. I have a little bit of a kicker story for the end because. Honestly, the French headlines haven't been super happy in the past few weeks. But So many of you have listened to the shows with Antoine, one about the French, political system. And then we talked about the Up All Night movement. And that hasn't let up. It's basically still going on and very active currently. And there are different... I'm sorry, there's someone. I can hear some noise in the background. Okay, it stopped. Excellent. Good job, guys. thinking of the listeners here. And the labor law protests are still very much going on. And the unions, some of the unions have started. Oh my God, what's happening? Guys, there's something in the background. Hello?
I don't think it's on my end.
Nope.
Franco? 1 minute. Let me. Oh, is it okay. Me? Wait.
Yeah, Turkey. It might be you. Who's vacuuming in the background? Turkey. Stop vacuuming as you're doing the show. I know you.
You
like
wouldn't
to-
believe this. You wouldn't believe this. This is my wife is heating water, and she's about 20 meters. So let me lower the gain of this thing.
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. Just mute yourself until it's done. It's fine. Sorry, we're back. The labor laws are still. So I don't even know how to describe what's happening in the country right now. The unions have started to block some of the oil, the ports and the oil refineries and the oil stocks that are in the country are being blocked as a means of pressure to the government. And it's starting to, I mean, some people think that we have enough oil and reserves to be fine, but then some people are saying if you can't refine the oil, then that's a problem and you're going to run out very quickly. There are already some gas stations that are running out. And, you know, it's like, I know that a few of you expressed surprise at Antoine's conviction, I want to say, during the last couple of episodes. And If you want to imagine how it is in France, imagine that there are many people like that, that are convinced that for the good of the country, you should do whatever you can to prevent this law from happening. The main issue they have with it is still that one article that says the agreements between branches of company would supersede the agreements of the whole company. And that's the main thing that they don't want to happen, because they want the agreements to the whole company to be the standard, and then you can only add rights to the workers and not the other way around. So over that, they're going to those lengths. And it's not the first time such a huge country-blocking strike has happened, but the last one was probably in 95. I remember it because I was going to university, and it was basically the whole country was stuck for weeks, and a bunch of companies went under because they couldn't get their supplies, and it was, you know, a huge thing. And the government is not letting up. They're not saying, you know, okay, fine, we're going to let go and we're not going to vote that low. They're saying it is important that we do this thing, and we're going to do it no matter how much the situation worsens. So, you know, I look at this. I don't know if it's because I'm from the outside, but I look at all of this and it's sort of a little bit of disbelief, and I don't want to say who's right and who's wrong, but it doesn't feel like this is the right
wrong
way to
end
go
of
about
story
it.
Come on.
Who's wrong? Who's wrong, Turkey? I wonder who you think is wrong.
You don't want to say it. The protesters. Okay. It's all these crazy people going out. Come on, that's not how you protest. You don't ruin and destroy your economy and your country and hurt other people's life by protesting. That's not how you protest. That's not a civilized way of protesting. Come on.
So what would be the civilized way of protesting?
The civilized way of protesting is signing petitions, letting people know, and voting for the right people to come in place and revoke those laws. You are a democracy. You are not some dictatorship where you have to go out and fight and blow things up and blockade so you can get your rights.
So they are doing the... I'm going to be devil's advocate for just a second here. They are doing all those things, and the petitions are huge, and the demonstrations have not stopped. And the government is using a specific legislative tool that allows them to bypass the parliamentary vote to get this law basically enacted without having to go.
Then in the next election, vote in a new government that would revoke that law. How difficult is that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it doesn't, you know, pushing to this extreme is not constructive, but yeah, and that's why, you know.
Can I? The last two episodes, I was not surprised to hear that French view. What I was surprised is that I finally came out to be right about French people, and you, because you ruined it. I thought French people were like you after I had that conception about them.
Well, I guess there are some like me and some like Antoine, but yeah, Bart, go ahead.
Well, it just strikes me that if, you know, if they're using techniques to try to avoid the parliament and stuff, then maybe that's not particularly democratic. So maybe that is a reason to, you know, sort of raise your voices a little bit. Like, this can't be like 2% of the people or something. There's got to be much bigger support for this movement than that.
Yeah, for sure. And the thing is, that tool, called 49.3, 49.3, is... like, I can't remember how it's called in the U.S. There is, the president can veto a law, right? Even though it has been voted. And there are these kinds of things in place so that things can still happen when you're in a stalemate or when things go a little bit crazy. I mean, there's a reason why those tools are at the, the government can use, and the presidency or the prime minister can use those tools. If we didn't want that to ever happen, then we wouldn't have those tools in place. I think it's not You know, it's like saying, I remember when we were talking about the European Union vote that happened a while back. It's like saying, well, you should have a referendum for every decision you make. Otherwise, it's not democratic. Well, not really. When you do things via the parliament, you still have indirect voting. So it happens. And what I'm saying is, if we're unhappy about that tool, then we should ask for that tool to be removed. But I don't think we want that either, because sometimes you need to do things in that way as well. And it's not a question of left or right or whoever is in power. I don't think anyone is ever going to take it away, because you understand that you sometimes need it. So,
yeah, I think that legislating by decree, I think it's the way, right? The name, I think it's just, it's a possibility. It's just that it is a little bit frowned upon, meaning that the country doesn't want the president to be legislating by decree all the time, many times. It's more the exception to the rule than the normal rule, I guess.
Right,
but it's true that it's a thing that it's legal in the sense that it's contemplated by the law and it's possible. I think the problem is that it's never clear when it's necessary to do it and when it's not, because of course being an exception, it's just weird to do it.
Yeah. No, I think. Oh, sorry, Bart. Did you want to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you started talking. It definitely should be the exception, and I think it is. You know, it doesn't happen very often at all. But yeah, it's like Turkey was saying, it gets that feeling that. So again, we did talk about it at length with Antoine, and there are certainly people who are making an argument for it, but no matter how much I talk about it, I still feel that it is unreasonable. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, internment camps here. The situation is dire in the country from the economic side, where we have large percentage of unemployment, and we've tried many different things, and they're suggesting we try another series of laws that are, yes, to the right of what those people protesting would like, but it's not like they're advocating, you know, murdering the old people to make place for the new. They're just saying we're going to do this and that thing that are going to change the labor laws in that way, which is not outlandish. It's not things that don't exist elsewhere and in countries where things work a little bit better. So in that context, it feels that the lengths to which they're going to protest feel at the very least unreasonable. You know, it's not something that you would expect for so anyway, we've talked about it at length in the previous episodes, and as a French person outside of France at the moment, there are those times, and I'm sure, you know, some other people from different countries feel that way about their country sometimes as well, when they do things that are not in alignment with what they think is reasonable. But it's a little bit of a facepalm situation. And it's like, and on the other hand, this is sort of my own psychotherapy here, so I'm sorry, please indulge me for a second. But I understand that the country works, you know. There's, when you describe France to anyone, it should not work. You know, it's got all of these interests that block the country when they're unhappy, and like, the economy of the country has been predicted to go the way of Greece or even Spain, you know, many times, but it doesn't. France, for some reason, we are productive, we have dynamic economies, even though it's, you know, obviously the world economy, except for the US maybe, is, and Japan, is not in great shape, but still, we are not going straight to the crapper. So I'm not saying, oh, they're ruining the country. I think that's the way the country has worked for a long time. And it still works relatively well, but it's just, I don't. You
these
know,
these people
makes me
are
sigh.
Just selfish. That's a simple answer. They're selfish.
Selfish.
If you want, as I said, demonstrate. Nobody's saying don't demonstrate. Oppose the law, but do it in a civilized way. Do it in a way where you don't harm other people, where you don't actually end up ruining the lives of other people. But going around using violence or using boycotting, blocking, and forcing people to go different paths or stuff like that is wrong. Like the entire oil situation right now in France, where all of these stations are being blocked and they're not even allowing anybody to work in them, which is less gas in gas stations. People can't travel as much as they need to. You're burning cars. You're destroying public property and private property. That's not how you do it. That's selfish because all you care is about yourself. You're going to try and force the government to change the law and you really don't care about anybody else.
Well, it's not that you're trying to force government to change, right? The government are trying to force through a change. There's a difference.
No, the government already got the law passed. It's done. Now they're trying to force the government to back out. It's done. The law is there.
I don't know that the law has been voted in already, has it? I don't think so.
As far as I know, it is.
Okay. Maybe. You know, it's so confusing that... But hey,
you should know better than me.
Yeah, I know. let me ask this.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Franco.
Just a quick reminder or question. Wasn't the law already watered down already? I mean, they tried to make first a law, and because of some protests, I remember they changed it again, right? First.
A little bit, yeah. They changed a few tidbits of it, but not the most important things. It's mostly symbolic at this point.
Not enough, maybe, yeah. Right? They change it, but not as much as other people want it to.
Yeah, the thing is, it's never going to be enough. They just want it removed completely now. But so let me ask you this, to both of you, actually, Franco and Bart. Turkey has made it pretty clear how he feels about those ways of protesting. Bart, what do you think about that, you know, the lengths to which the French unions or one of the unions is going to for those protests?
I'm not quite saying I entirely agree with it, but I do have to say I admire the French for their ability to protest, because we had some pretty draconian stuff come in Ireland. Our government basically decided to bail out the banks when they were actually European banks because we're in the euro, and they basically threw our entire GDP down the toilet, and we didn't do anything. We didn't do anything, and we probably should have. So I do kind of admire the French for at least having the gusto to get up and do something when they're cranky. Whereas, you know, in Ireland, we just kind of, we moan about it, we grumble about it, and that's kind of all we do.
Right.
So I admire them in one way, but I'm not sure they haven't gone too far over too little this time. I don't know enough to be definitive, but the sense I'm getting is that maybe this is out of proportion.
All right, fair enough. Franco, what do you think?
I think I'm between maybe Bart and Turkey. I really personally do not approve. Again, I'm not representing the whole Latin America. Or
of course you are. Of course you are. You're speaking for the entire continent.
Right. So I personally do not approve that kind of a violent protests or actions that, you know, harm or affect the lives of other people. But on the contrary, I do think that, as Bart was saying, I really think that at least the French people think that they can change something. At least they have the will or the naivety, maybe, of thinking they can actually make the a better government or choose a better people. I mean, comparing it to Peru, for example, people are just so disappointed of anything that happens in politics. They just don't expect anything. So they vote just by default. They actually do not trust anyone, and they just do not expect politics to, for example, comply with their word. So it's good to see that there's people that still actually think they can make a difference. I don't know. The idealist part, I like it. The maybe the protest, the way they do it, I do not support it.
All right. Yeah, that's fair enough. I think that's a silver lining, even for me. So
let me put one last point on this.
Go ahead.
Simply put, the French people, they say democracy is good and they promote democracy around the world, just like the US, just like the UK and all of these worlds. To be honest, clearly for me, I don't see democracy working. If you have to go out and protest and build and burn, then democracy is not working. So why bother? Do I need democracy here? No. That's the message. Well,
part of democracy.
That's the message they're giving out.
Part of democracy is the right to and the peaceful, ability to protest, peaceful, to hold your government peaceful, accountable. Peaceful, yeah, I agree. It should protest. Be peaceful, right?
I'm talking about this type of protest. I'm not talking about peaceful protest. Peaceful protest is okay. But what's going on, that's not peaceful.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. I don't think anyone here is saying, oh, yeah, break things. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I think Turkey is trolling a little bit. And I also think that, just a little bit. But I also think that, even, let's say you're right, it's still, I think, is it Churchill who said that? Any great quote is always Churchill. Democracy is the least, it's the best, it's the worst form of governance, except for all the other ones, right? So it's the best one we have, and unfortunately these things happen. I'll still take, democracy over any other thing that I've seen at the moment, except probably if we do a dictatorship where we have one dictator that I'm certain I'm going to agree with 100% of the time, I would be okay with that, which means I should probably be the dictator. Can we get a vote? Yes, yes, yes. All right, good.
I think you don't need votes if you want to be a dictator, actually.
Yeah, you don't need votes. And plus, I'm just going to start a coup and take it over, so don't worry.
Ah, that's why you've been buddying up to me for all those years. Makes sense now. All right. There were other things happening in France. There's sexual harassment scandals coming out of the political arena, and basically a number of women have started talking about the sexual harassment they've been victims of for the past, years and decades, and very respected members of the political field and journalists. And it's just a reminder that it's kind of like racism in the US with the Black Lives Matter movement and things, where at some point we sort of figured, all right, racism is over, sexism is over, and we're good now. But now, for the past few years, we're sort of realizing, actually, not really. We still have a long way to go. So I just wanted to mention it, and some horrendous things happening from, a number of people coming forward, women coming forward and saying what's been happening, which is everyone knows about it in those, in the close circles of those environments, but no one talks about it. And now people are starting to talk about it. And another thing, sort of a funnier story. Have you guys heard of the Soldiers of Odin?
Is that some sort of fantasy TV show? I have no idea what that is.
It sounds like fun, but it's actually a sort of militia in Finland with far-right people patrolling the streets and making sure that the streets are safe from those evil immigrants harassing the Finnish women. And they say that they will, just call the police if they see something, but it's that ridiculous institutionalized almost racism in the country. And the most wonderful thing happened a few weeks ago. There was someone who got the trademark for Soldiers of Odin, except they weren't affiliated with the militia, with the far-right militia. It was someone completely different. And they are now making Soldiers of Odin t-shirts and other items of clothing with unicorns and rainbows and general anti-racism messaging. So I thought that was awesome. It made me smile.
It sounds like Finland, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it Finland who had speakers underwater for Russian submarines playing gay songs or something when Putin got a bit?
I don't remember that, but it would not surprise me at all. The Finns are an interesting people. I'll have to ask my wife about the gay song speakers underwater. That sounds like a fun program.
How is Finland with gun laws? I mean, are these white supremacists wandering around with armed to protect people, or just wandering around looking?
No, they're people? You know, the Finns, they're cute. They have knives. Everyone has a knife, and they have lots of guns in the, you know, because they live in the forest and they hunt a lot and stuff like that, but they don't have a gun violence problem. And those soldiers of Odin, I really don't think they walk around with guns. They don't have that. It's not an issue. Guns aren't an issue in the country, even though they do have many, or they did. But
okay. Well, no, it's just, if you think about something like that happening in America, they would be armed.
Oh, yeah, of course. But, well, they have Minutemen in America patrolling the Mexican border and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's not the same, you know, and even the soldiers of Odin, you know, they sort of profess their, not their ethnicity quite as much. I guess they do, but it's also the soul of Finland. And Odin is obviously a god of the pantheon of another country. Finland has nothing to do with the Swedish pantheon of, you know, Valhalla and all of this. It's, if you look at Finland, it's the Kalevala, which is a completely separate thing. So they were like, oh, soldiers of Odin, it sounds awesome. Yes, let's do it. It's ridiculous. T-shirts with rainbows and unicorns. That's what it is now. All right. Move on to, I've spoken way too long. Bart, what's been happening in Ireland?
Well, the story that's been consuming us for quite some time now is our election, which usually in Ireland, actually, we're known for having short elections. So by US standards, they think we're nuts because we call an election and then 4 weeks later we vote and then we're done. And so the whole thing just happens in a month.
That which sounds like a sane standards. Way of doing it, but
I think it works quite well, as I guess it's somewhat on the British model in that way. So we had our election in February. Well, it was called in February and we had it on, oh yeah, we had it on the 26th of February. So technically this shouldn't be a story in May, but it didn't quite go to plan. We had our vote on the 26th of May and nobody won.
What?
Or at least nobody coherent won. So we've had coalition governments for decades now,
so,
because no one party.
Just for a second, what elections were those?
Okay, our national parliament. So we have a parliamentary system. So our prime minister is elected by the parliament and the parliament is elected by the people.
Right.
And we also have something called a single transferable vote. Which is a big problem with a lot of election systems is that they don't result in a parliament that matches the people's opinion. So David Cameron is Prime Minister of the UK, but he only got about his party only got a third of the votes, but they have the majority in parliament. So there's a big difference between the percentage of people who are in favor of a party and the percentage of seats in the Houses of Parliament who, you know, matching that because they have first past the post. So we have a very different system where our constituencies have at least three seats and a maximum of five. And you get what's called a single transferable vote. So you don't put one tick box. You rank the people to as far as you want. So you give people your first preference, your second preference, your third preference. Now, you can stop at any time, but you may keep going until you run out of people. And then so they count all the votes and the lowest person is eliminated and all of their votes then go to the person who's next preference on that vote. And so the votes get redistributed and then the next lowest person is eliminated and the next lowest person is eliminated. And you keep eliminating until you're left with the number of seats available. So if it's a 5-seat constituency, you eliminate all but five and then those five are deemed elected. So our parliament genuinely does represent the various party beliefs of the people. But that's problematic because we don't have a two-party system. We have many parties. And so no one party ever wins overall, or hasn't since 1977 was the last time someone had an overall majority here. So it's not surprising that no one party won. But the problem is no two parties who could conceivably, feasibly form a government together have enough seats to get half. So there are no alliances possible. And the reason there's no alliances possible is largely because of stupid history, as these things tend to go. So in 1922, Ireland had a civil war. 1922. And we have two centre-right Christian Democratic parties who detest each other. And those two parties have the majority of the seats, and they could form a government, but they can't because they refuse to work with each other. So that's why it took from the 26th of February until the 6th of May until we had a new prime minister sworn in.
And it took, so it did get resolved.
It did get resolved in a very Irish way. So the two centre-right parties are not in coalition.
What, did they have a drinking contest?
I think there may have been some alcohol consumed. But no, they've decided that the party with the most seats. So we have our government is now formed of a party with 50 seats and our parliament has 158 seats. So that's not like a minority government with six short. That's a government with more than 100 votes short to do anything. And they are being not in government with their other Christian Democratic opposition. However, the other Christian Democrats have agreed that they'll vote with the government on certain issues. And they basically worked out a 3-year plan for government. And they're officially not in government, but they kind of are. And that way they get to keep their, you know, they get to hold face and the country gets to have a government. So it's very
unique. I need some Tylenol or Panadol or whatever you guys take. Where is it?
You know, I think it's... the thought that came to me initially, ironically, was, wow, this is democracy at its best. You know, like the thing that cannot, the protests in France and the thing that can't get resolved because the votes don't add up. But actually, it in Ireland, at least, it did get resolved. It's a little bit messy.
Yes.
But it is democracy at its best. It's people who don't agree, who would never agree, who instead of going down in the streets with pikes and forks and guns and shooting each other to decide who's the strongest, actually mm-hmm. Are forced to sit down at a table and scream and yell and you know, maybe drink. But then they have to resolve it as, you know, Turkey put it very eloquently, civilized people, right?
Yeah, and actually a very strange thing. So because this government is a minority government, we have independent members of our parliament in cabinet positions, which has never happened before, because generally speaking, the parties who form the government take all the cabinet posts because the prime minister appoints the cabinet and therefore he appoints his own party. But he needed the help of 9 independents in order to get himself elected as prime minister, because he got elected not by winning a majority, but by his natural opposition abstaining. So he won the prime ministership with 59 votes in a parliament of 158 people. So basically everyone sort of put a sort of like a clothes peg for Le Pen kind of thing. They didn't vote against him, but they didn't vote for him either.
You know,
so it's very strange.
It is incredibly strange, but it makes me strangely hopeful. You know, maybe not hopeful, but I guess it makes me believe in democracy more. You know, if even those unsolvable issues manage to, not ideally, but somehow get resolved, it works. It's the least worst system we have. I'll settle for that, honestly. But yeah. I don't know.
Everyone here is very upset because it took so long to form a government, but the Belgian half of me was laughing at them all.
Right.
The last time Belgium voted,
I remember
it
that.
Took them 435 days to form a government. Because they also always end up with coalitions. But they have the problem that half the country hates the other half of the country, and therefore French and Flemish parties have to agree with each other in order to form a government, and that wasn't happening. So I think 65 days is fine. I think the Irish could be, you know, the Irish are doing okay.
Yeah, Spanish, I would say, would be happy to have only 65 days to get a government. We're still trying.
How long is that then?
I think the elections were in December, and I think it's on June that they're going to have finally the elections again. The final decision was at the end to get new elections and see what happens.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there's no guarantee that there's going to be a government still.
Wow. So we almost came close to that, actually, but the Irish president sort of stepped in at the last, a few days before it all got resolved, the Irish president stepped in and went, by the way, I have the constitutional power to fire you all.
Yeah.
Just letting you know. Have a nice day.
That sounds like a good constitutional power to have for a president who I'm guessing doesn't do a lot more in Ireland.
No, the president is very ceremonial. The president has to sign every law, and the president has responsibility for making sure the laws are constitutional by referring every law that he or she is skeptical of to the highest court in the land. So the only time the president tends to come up is when there's a law that's a bit dubious and the question is, will it or won't it go to the courts?
Right, right.
And then also the president dissolves parliament, and the president can dissolve parliament for any reason he or she would like.
Right. So, Franco, what can you tell us a little bit of how it's going in your corner of the world? Because you were saying you wanted to talk about elections as well.
Yes, sure. I'm not really an expert on politics, be it Spanish or Peruvian, but I think that it's interesting still to discuss a little bit about the elections in both countries. There were elections in Spain in December. I think I don't get to vote in those, but of course I've been updated or been reading, of course, and discussing it with a lot of people. So there were elections in December. They were very interesting elections in the sense that finally, for a long time, Spain has had only two main parties that have been switching governments since the dictatorship ended. And I would guess more or less just like France.
It's been going in France as well. It's left, right, left, right. A lot of right, a little bit of left, surprisingly.
And these elections, what happened, and it was predicted to be like this. What happened is that there's now more or less four main parties. Talking about democracy, that's everyone I think agrees here that that's a good thing. even if you don't support the parties that are the new ones.
I think almost everyone except Turkey agrees democracy is a good thing.
I'm not saying democracy is not a good thing, but that's not democracy when you're rioting in the streets.
One of these parties, Podemos, actually rose because of the protests some years ago. So in that sense, I'm not saying it's justified, but it's curious how because of a protest group of people actually decided to make something about it, and they formed a party to go into elections. So yeah, I don't know. even something can come from protests, I guess. They were peaceful, but still.
Yeah, I think just to set the record straight, I think a lot of good things can come from protests, and sometimes from protests which. We mentioned it on the last show, but from protests in which old people like me would say, oh, those kids, they're being violent and blah, blah, blah. You know, the 68 protests in France, I'm sure, made a lot of people unhappy. I would have been unhappy about those, but the results were necessary. So just, you know, putting a little bit of perspective there. But sorry, keep going.
There's this sense or spirit of uncertainty. For a whole of this year, these four parties have been discussing between them possible coalitions, and obviously they haven't got anything decided. The broadly speaking, the possibilities were a grand left-right coalition, meaning the old party coalition, the two old parties, PP and PSOE, uniting in a one government. That didn't happen. Another option was a big left coalition, but being there so many left-wing parties, it wasn't also possible. So I remember when Bart was talking about the precedent here, there's no precedent, but there's a king. So the king tried to make parties talk to each other. So there were, again, this has happened for the whole of this year, a lot of meetings and a lot of talking and speculating. But at the end, I think they just realized that it was not going to happen. And it's because the pledges between the parties have been so different that no one wants to give part of their promises to make a coalition, because part of the two new parties, part of what they stand for is they reject the old ones. So it's at least from my point of view, it's for them a question of principle that they cannot unite with the old ones, because then they're betraying the people that voted for them. So I'm guessing it's really complicated, and that they're predicting that in the June elections there's not going to be, because of the polls, the polls predict that in June the elections will return the same results or very similar ones. And and so no one knows what's going to happen, if Spain's going to keep like this in emergency mode without a government for very long. And people are discussing Belgium, and they're saying if Belgium did it, why can't we?
Well, actually, just you mentioned, right, so just to say, the reason it worked in Belgium without destroying the country was Belgium is very, very decentralized. So yeah, there is a national parliament, but the Flemish parliament has an awful lot of power, and the Wallonian parliament has an awful lot of power, and then each within those, even the local governments have an awful lot of power. So what people in Belgium noticed was that the national government really isn't very important. And I think the only reason it got solved was because the national government were afraid that if they didn't get their act together, there wouldn't be a nation for them to govern, because they'd just split in half and go their own way.
That would be one way to solve the issue. But you know, it's
very practical.
Yeah. In the north, they seem to be a little bit more practical than central and southern Europeans like us. We get hung up on the details and principle a lot. And it seems like, you know, in the north and in the more Protestant countries, they at some point they sit down and think, all right, we actually have to solve this. So let's be realistic about everything and discuss things like adults and find a solution, because we can't just, you know, it needs to be worked out. Whereas we'll go to, you know, any length to protect the principles. Turkey, you were saying they're selfish in France. And I think there is some of that, a little bit of individuality. But I think it's also caring about your principles so much that you won't let go of them for anything, even if you desperately need a practical solution. I think there's some of that too.
I just want to throw in, right, Ireland and Belgium, not Protestant countries.
Right.
Very,
no,
very,
yeah, yeah.
Very not Protestant countries in the case of
no,
Ireland.
No, of course, yeah. No, I mean, I'm always, now, anytime I talk about anything, my vision is colored by Scandinavia and Finland. And in those countries, they seem to be, you know, trying to resolve the issues. But yeah, you're right. Obviously, it doesn't apply there. But I also, you know, there's something a pattern of rejection of establishment that seems to be worldwide, because I mean, obviously we all know what's happening with Trump in the US, and you know, I was talking about facepalm with the French things happening earlier. I think the US is, anyway, we should discuss that. I don't think it can be discussed more, but in France there is certainly it feels like there is this boiling over of no matter who you vote for, things don't change. And for every different kind of reason, you know, in many different places, it's not even, again, it's not a thing about the right or the left. It's people, you know, the rise of the far right is in Europe is very often a protest against the established parties, which have been here since the end of World War II, and that the people feel aren't fixing issues. I think to an extent, the movements of the far left in France and Spain and Greece are also reactions to the people feel like they're not being heard. So I don't know if there's anything to take away from that, but it's a sentiment that I think is getting common in many different places for different reasons, but with the same core. Is that, does that bring any truth to you guys?
Oh yeah. I think it's relevant to what you were saying previously about democracy, and I think that I do not support the protest, these protest parties that are coming, but it is true that it's the way that we have decided here just a little bit some minutes before, that it's the way that people have to protest peacefully. It's just to vote for someone else, and I think that it's again democracy at its best, saying people saying we don't like these governments, and it's how democracy has taught people that it's how you tell the politics that they're not representing you, and they're not doing what you want them to do. I'm sure a lot of people are not voting for these protest parties because they support them, but it's a way at least to say to the old establishment, you cannot assume that we are going to vote for you forever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think in Europe, I think a lot of the reason people are cranky, upset, betrayed by the establishment is because of the way that the European Union is governed, which is supremely undemocratic. It's kind of I think it's astounding that a group of democracies have decided to club together in the least democratic union I have ever seen. I mean, it is amazing.
I'm thinking if it was more democratic, it just wouldn't work. Everyone is protecting their interests so much that we would never find common ground. It's worse than the US, you know? They have at least the idea of America and freedom that binds them together. Not freedom, I'm not trying to troll. The idea of America is binding them together. In Europe, the right. idea of Europe is not, you know, it's very artificial still. In an extremely practical way, the interests of each country in different industries is completely different. You have some countries that are agrarian, some countries which have services, some countries where, you know, it's silly things like the movie industry in France is huge, and that has implications in copyright law and trademark law and these kinds of things, you know. So I don't think it would be possible.
But why is there no sense of Europeanness? The reason is because we don't actually get to have a say in Europe. We elect members of parliament who, in most, particularly in the parliamentary systems, they then elect a prime minister who then chooses a government, and those governments then choose people to send to Europe. That's so many layers away from people at the ballot box. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
and
Europe has achieved a lot. Europe has achieved a lot.
Oh yeah, it
and
has.
Europe is a great example of how people can be unified, and I'm saying this because I'm coming from a background that people here are pissed as hell because we are Arabs, we follow the same religion, Islam, and everything, and we are still divided, and we could never agree on anything unifying. You get to the European Union, people of different religious backgrounds, different languages, different ethnicities, different everything, and they are uniting under one banner. It's still an amazing achievement for Europe. So I really don't see where the problem is.
No, it's an amazing achievement, but it's an incomplete process, and I think it's stagnated a bit. Like, there hasn't been a big change in Europe in quite some time. The European Union has sort of ground to a halt, and an establishment has set in, and who just like to do things the way we've always done things.
It grew too fast. That's the problem. Growing too fast. They added too many countries before they can even establish the basics correctly.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's very fair.
But on the other hand, remember, it grew really fast after the fall of the Eastern Bloc. And I think at that point, getting the old Eastern countries into Europe to sort of get them away from the sphere of influence of Russia might have been a good thing, because it's, well, a good thing for Europe. And many times they're some of the very stable economies, surprisingly, you know, because they're new and young, and they have, you know, after the end of communism, they had this energy and thirst for things. I think it's yes, in some ways it hurt the European identity a little bit that we integrated so many people so quickly, but I think on the overall picture it might have been a positive thing for the stability of the continent. But
well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to be anti. Well, I'm not. I'm actually very, very pro-European, because I think we're much better off getting into larger groupings instead of, you know, small parochial national interests. But my concern is that the European Union is going to disintegrate if it doesn't react to the fact that it's not working well. We had a major financial crisis, and the European Union reacted in gridlock. It just locked up. It achieved
because basically Europe just looked at growing before they even worked on making sure everything is working correctly.
Well, okay.
Yeah, they were too aggressively looking at growth.
Be that as it may, now that's the situation we have, so we have to deal with it. But
yes, which is why I'm saying we need there needs to be European reform to keep this project on the rails. And I want it on the rails. I want Europe to succeed, but I know that if things don't change, it is going to fall apart. And my neighbors across the water here in the UK may throw a gigantic wrench into the cogs within the next month.
Yeah, they're voting for their Brexit. But, you know, we have European parliamentary elections. We have, I mean, a more direct democracy form of governance for Europe would federalize it even more. It would take away, I think, you know, maybe I'm not looking at this right, but it would take away even more power and from each constituting country,
right,
and bring it into the, and that is not something that people want, I think.
Well, I think people need, I'm not sure what your, there's a certain phrase, pooper get off the pot. I'd like to use the word poop isn't used.
Yeah.
You know, if we are moving towards a more united Europe, then we need to keep moving towards a more united Europe. Either we're a union or we're not. You know, the United States of Europe is not the boogeyman. The United States of Europe is how you have a successful large union. The United States of America shows the way. And our biggest problem is around economics.
Yeah.
And the United States of America does not suffer in recessions the way Europe does, because they have a united currency and a central bank and stuff that is working properly. So when a state suffers, massive money flows from the central coffers into that state. When Ireland, Spain, and Greece suffered, we were left to suffer. Yeah. That's not how it works.
I completely agree, and I would root for a more unified, federalized, centralized Europe in many ways, but I think that's going to be a very tough pill to swallow for many Europeans. But I'm with you. I agree. I think we should, you know, in your metaphor, we should poop, not get off the pot. I think that's the way it works.
Yes, exactly.
Right? All right. Do you want to say a few words about the Peruvian elections, Franco, before we move on to Saudi Arabia?
Very, very quick ones. I was thinking on doing a parallel with Europe's slowness or Spain's celebration of four parties. In Peru, we had elections in April. In these ones, I have to vote. I vote, but I also have to, because they are obligatory in Peru. And imagine this: in Spain, they're happy because they have four parties. In Peru, we had 17. Parties in our elections. I don't know if that's good, but if democracy is the number of parties, then we're very democratic in Peru. And it's actually very strange, because there's so many parties that even the main ones, there were like six main ones, so it was still very divided, the vote. And then I mean three or four were more or less the same ideas. So it's, I think in Peru, it's a quite a different way of voting. You vote for the president and you vote for the face of the people. If you trust the guy who's leading the party, you vote for the party. And well, we had elections in April. As always, none of the candidates got more than 50% of the vote.
Yeah, with 17 parties, I would guess.
Yeah, it's quite splitted, right? So we're having another elections in June, I think. So we're having them together with Spain, I guess. And the options are two parties that are not really that different one from the other. So right now they're just fighting really hard to make each other different from the other competitor.
What did I miss?
Just the Peruvian elections with 17 parties. It's fine. More democracy that you hate or like, or I don't even know anymore now.
Well, I have a question, actually. So obviously you have your first election where you vote for the leaders of the party, and then you have the runoff election where you get the final answer. So how do you qualify to go from the first election to the second election? How do you get your name into the second option?
You need the vote, the two most voted parties go to the second election. So it's every count, every vote counts as one vote. And they just through the whole country, and they just sum all the votes for each party, and the two that have the most votes go to the second round.
So
the
that
first
should be
party
easy.
Was, yeah,
that should be easy. Even if the two highest voted parties have 7 and 11%, they're the ones that go to the second round, and then you're done.
Yeah. Where is it? Yeah, it's weird, but then you end up with a very split parliament, because when you choose your president, you also vote for the parliament.
Right.
And so you don't need to choose the parliament for the same party as the president, actually. I think. But the thing is that even most people do. And at the end, of course, you end up with a parliament with a lot of parties. And only one president, but the president can have not much representation in the parliament, I guess, the president's party. In this case, the candidate of the party that got the most votes, which is Fuerza Popular, I think, has a sizable part of the parliament this time, but it's not usually the case. So you end up with very politics that do not work very much because, you don't have much, I don't know, you're not very united you make those.
And then you can't get any law to be voted on and stuff like that. Again, as we were saying, democracy at its best. That's, the way it works.
Well, right. To be honest, it kind of is good, though, because it means that only stuff that has a broad appeal gets through the parliament, because you can't vote for you can't propose something with a narrow interest, because then one out of 17 will go yes, and 16 out of 17 will go no.
So it has
advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, exactly, because then maybe you didn't decide anything, and then what's better, to decide something that is not very good or nothing at all? It's hard to say.
That is the big question.
Making it a little more fun. I don't know if it's fun for Peruvians, but the candidate, the first that has the most votes right now is a woman. First of all, she would be the first president if she's elected. Her name is Keiko Fujimori, which sounds very Japanese,
there are lots of Japanese.
There are a lot of Japanese in Peru, actually, and she's actually the daughter of an ex-president in Peru who is in jail right now. and who tried to stay more time than he was supposed to, And there's a long history. You can search for it. He was from the 90s to the 2000s. Alberto Fujimori. It has probably gotten in the news at some point. And so the idea is people vote for her because she's her daughter. But it doesn't mean that she has anything valuable as skills for being a president, and so it's because of the popularity of his parent, her father, that she's being elected. And and again, Alberto Fujimori is a very controversial character in Peru. A lot of people hate it. And a lot of people have good memories of the government, I guess. So yeah, it's weird.
Well, yeah. Again, another one. I think thanks, Franco. I really hope that Turkey, you have found some election for something in the entire, your neighborhood to talk about, because this is going to be entirely about elections and democracy.
I got a gigantic headache right now, guys. Democracy is too much. Yeah, too much work.
Exactly. It's you don't have to worry about those things. You don't have democracy. You're fine. All right. What do you have for us today, Turkey?
Well, there's not much going on here. It's mostly quiet. But in Saudi itself.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. We'll talk to you next. No. What? No.
I'm still talking here. In Saudi, the biggest events were a recent reshuffle in the government, new ministers, changes in ministries, and there is what we call the Vision 2030, which Saudi Arabia has announced, and which part
Vision
of it which 2030? Is the biggest.
Oh, so like for the year 2030, where are you going to go?
Yes, yeah, from now until 2030, what is the government planning to achieve?
Oh, that's interesting.
And the biggest news out of that is economical, which is basically the person responsible for the vision is the deputy crown prince. He's the son of the king, and his vision is that they would be putting 5% of Saudi Aramco. Aramco is the Saudi oil company, which controls the entire oil in Saudi Arabia. They want to put 5% of that in the stock market.
Really?
So I think, yeah, and that's about valued at around, I think, $200 billion.
Okay, that sounds...
Only the 5%. That's the 5%. That's only the 5%, $200 billion.
So wait a second. When you were saying Saudi's Vision 2030, I thought you were going to talk about like how to develop some kind of industry that would, allow for the country
It includes all of that stuff. It includes employment, privatization, promoting religious tourism, promoting foreign investment. Has a lot of stuff, but the biggest number one news that if it actually happens is going to hit the market is that they're going to sell 5% of the Saudi Aramco in the stock market.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So you mean they're going to let private investors get into the capital of the Saudi oil? Oh, okay. All right.
So you would own part of the Saudi oil company,
which has been property of the country and the
it's
prince
been privatized
and the king
since the 80s, early 80s. It's been privatized. Before that, it was partly owned by Americans. It was an American company. It was privatized in the 80s. It's valued right now, according to the market, at $2 trillion.
Sorry, when you say privatized, you mean it was taken, it was nationalized?
Sorry, not privatized. Nationalized, sorry.
Right. Nationalized. Okay.
Yeah, they're going to privatize part of it right now, which is 5% of it they want to.
I think Saudi Aramco is the biggest company in the world or something.
It is. Value-wise, it is. It's valued at $2 trillion.
Jeez. Okay. What are they going to do with the money?
They're supposed, according to that, one of the plans is they're going to start an investment fund, a government fund to invest internationally, and they're going to put that money into that fund.
Okay. And that's another thing. They're going to have about 2 trillion values of an investment fund, a government investment fund, to invest internationally.
Hmm. 2 trillion?
Yeah. 2 trillion.
Dollars?
Yep.
But, yeah, really? How much
that's
is...
That's the plan.
That's so much money, it's hard to comprehend. How much did you say the old company was valued for?
It was the value of the same amount that they want to put in the fund, but they're bringing different sources. But
okay,
to in the fund, but one of it is the $200 billion they're gonna.
Right, that's sell from the 5%. Right, right.
The shares, yeah, the shares they're gonna sell, and the rumor is there's nothing official yet that they're gonna sell it in 3 different markets at the same time, which is gonna be in New York, London, and Hong Kong.
But isn't oil on the way out, though? Isn't, like, if you want an investment, you want, if you want to buy this, you want it to get a return of
not exactly.
It's
oil, and I personally don't believe oil is ever going to be on the way out. Oil is going to be around as long as it's there, because you can't switch.
But it won't be there forever.
Yeah, as I said, as long as it's there. And it's going to be there, at least in Saudi at the moment. Estimates are 80 years still of oil reserves.
So 2030 is nowhere near the end of oil.
Yeah. And the other thing, Aramco is a huge, gigantic company, and it's invested in other investments. It's also investing right now. It started investing in alternative energies, so it doesn't do only oil. And, of course, it owns a lot of petrochemical companies also. So it's a diverse economy, and to be honest, I'm not sure about this plan. I don't think it's a great idea to even sell 5% of that company, privatization. I think the amount of headaches we're going to get out of it is going to exceed the benefits we're going to get out of it. Because right now Aramco is mostly protected by international law because it's 100% government owned. So as soon as you put part of it on the market, then it's not government protected anymore by international law. So you can sue it. You can go after it for any reasons, discrimination in the workplace, accuse it of financing terrorism or whatever. For any reason, they can go after it. And I really don't think that's a good idea.
But Turkey, I think that from what I've read, I thought that the idea of the privatization of part privatization was to reform it, also to have the chance to reform it, not only because of the money. I don't know. It's a way of the government trying to say we want to reform the company, and the way is bringing people from outside to, I don't know. Or maybe it's an excuse to reform it or something.
It's some of the stuff that is being said is that. But to be honest, there's way more important companies to reform, because Aramco is one of the best run companies in Saudi Arabia. So why do you want to reform and fix something that's running perfectly when you have other disasters that really need to be fixed?
Is this being so, I'm not sure if sold is right, or is this being publicized as an opportunity for, you know, regular Saudi Arabians to get a share of that wealth? Because I know in Ireland when we went on a little bit of a
Indirectly, because the details have not been announced exactly how they're going to do it, but indirectly they are hinting that that's what they're targeting to. Part of it is to be sold to individuals in Saudi if they want and to own part of the company.
That, Doug, we've had in Ireland we went through a little phase of copying Margaret Thatcher because that was the done thing back in the 80s, I guess.
Yeah,
actually later than that. And we had state-run telecommunications and we privatized it, and it was sold to the people as a way for you to make a little bit of quick money, you know, join in, invest in Aircom. And the shares were overvalued. And basically, it effectively lost the government the election because people invested in Aircom having been told it was a safe bet. The stock went through the floor, and people who probably shouldn't have invested money because they didn't have spare money lost money, and it put an end to our fetish for privatization.
Well, from my experience and understanding, we're more careful here. We don't privatize the entire company immediately. So usually, for example, we had some privatization years ago.
for the telecommunications company. So you had the Saudi telecommunication company, STC, and the government still owns part of it until today, even though it's on the stock market, it was sold to the public and everything. So they kind of make sure at least to control it for a while, to make sure the price doesn't crash for a while. And then when the market is stabilized and it's recognized as an independent company and running, then they let it free. Then that's the responsibility of the individuals. But when you go into stock here, when it first, and our stock market, by the way, is compared to internationally, is very small. Like, I don't know if we have even 100 companies right now in the stock market in Saudi. Okay. So it's not that. So people are aggressively buying in the stock market right now. It's a volatile. We did have a crash in the stock market. I think it was 2006 or something. I really can't remember. It was a huge crash, but those weren't brand new companies. Those were just people playing the stock market and ended up finally crashing when everything was exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, I think if they sell the stock to individuals in Saudi, it's not going to crash, at least not in the first period, like in the first month or two. And most Saudis here, there's two types of Saudis. They are short-term and long-term investors in stock market. The majority, they buy the stock in the IPO and they sell it as soon as it's on the market. Because as soon as it's on the market, the price goes up like 10, 20%, sometimes even 100%. And they just sell it immediately. Yeah. A few minority actually just hold on to it and keep it in their portfolio. So,
all right. So, Turkey, I want to get rich quick. Should I buy some stock?
Me, personally, I think the worst thing to do is buy stock, especially in Saudi Arabia.
All right. Thank you for your advice. That is all I needed to know. Ooh, oh my God, they're coming to get you. Quick.
That was my morning alarm clock.
Oh,
that was me. That was my alarm clock saying it's time to get up.
That's how you get up? Oh my God, that would be so stressful.
That's scary. Dude.
Yeah. It's the Star Trek red alert. It works.
Oh, right. Makes sense. It makes sense. All right.
My wife would kill me if she heard that.
Well, you wake up at least. Apparently, it was difficult to wake up. So there you go. All right. I think that is going to bring us to the end of the show. Unless anyone has something to add, I think we should be.
We haven't
good.
Talked about the Egypt Air.
Do we have to, though?
I don't know anything.
Well, I want to see your opinion.
Well, we don't know anything. Do we?
We don't know that yet, though.
Yeah, but it's the most acceptable theory at the moment. It's because there's only two things that will bring it down. It's either terrorism or technical faults.
Well, it could be technical faults.
You know, it could be technical, yeah.
Turkey just wants to... You just want to breed controversy and anger and frustration, don't you?
I don't need to do that. I'm sure the Western media has been doing that very well without my help.
Actually, I don't think so. I haven't seen a lot of alarmist... I mean, I haven't been following it closely, but I haven't seen any, oh my God, it's terrorists rhetoric. Have you guys?
Oh, yeah. I heard
apart
a lot
from the U.S.
that.
Election.
Okay. Bart?
Like it's Donald Trump isn't... Donald Trump isn't pretending that there's any doubt. Trump is just saying flat out he's terrorist because he's Donald Trump and that's what he does.
Right, but that's Donald Trump. I'm talking about local media.
Okay. So Donald Trump, how scared are people that he actually might win?
Bloody very. I mean...
I'm starting to get scared. I kept on saying there's no way, even if he wins the Republican vote, he wouldn't win. But Clinton is not helping. She's becoming a bigger idiot by the time.
I think the important thing is to make people believe that Trump is going to be elected, so they get scared and vote against him, and then he doesn't get elected. I think that's very important because if people are afraid that he's going to be elected, they will not vote for him, and then they will all be saved.
Maybe. You know, I was talking about this on Twitter a couple of days ago, and it's, I mean, obviously it's not funny anymore, and it hasn't been funny for a while. Now he has the nomination. He is the Republican nominee, right?
No, not yet.
I mean, not yet, but he has the votes. It would be very surprising if he wasn't. And it's a mix of bewilderment, and it's literally, I mean, it's electing a clown, and I don't know. Some people, I was saying, you know, if the Trump actually ends up becoming president, it will do more harm to the image of the U.S. and the standing of the U.S. in the world than anything the U.S. have ever done, you know, in the past. Good things, which were good to their standing, or bad things. Like, there's nothing worse that could happen for the U.S. to be discredited. Like, anything they do after that. I was saying, again, on Twitter, I was saying, let's say they cure cancer, or, you know, give us the iPhone 17, or come and save us from the Germans again. No matter what they do after that,
people start unfollowing you.
No matter what they do after that, it will always be, yeah, that's cool, but remember that time Trump was your president, and then you fall over laughing. It's unconscionable to me. And I understand that, you know, Clinton is apparently not ideal. But the fact that, and I mean the other nominees, and I don't understand. How can a country consider this? And I was saying this, and I had people telling me on Twitter, oh, but you know, in France we had this and that. And I'm sure that in every country you've had people that you weren't happy were elected prime minister or president or whatever. But there's no comparison. There's no comparison. It's like electing a comedian who's a bad comedian at that. I think that's that goes back to this idea that people are just pissed, angry with the establishment, quote unquote. That, you know, and it manifests itself in different ways in different countries. In France, it's people blocking the oil reserves. In Spain, it's people voting for 15 different parties. And in the US, it's people voting for Trump because they're just angry and they're like, whatever.
And that's what I think is the worst thing about the US, is that it's a two-party democracy. Yeah. That's the worst thing about the US.
It's only one party away from being a one-party state.
Yeah. I guess.
Seriously, it's when the choice is, when it's so ingrained that it's going to be one party or the other party, you end up with two establishments. Your only choice is establishment. It doesn't lead to a particularly healthy democratic debate. I mean, okay, they chose Donald Trump, but what was their choice? Like, look at the other 18 candidates who were put forward. Were any of them any more sane? Really, I mean, they were all more, I believe, the toilet trained, but their actual policies, their actual economics were based on...
No, some of them were sane, but the top group were not sane.
The top runners...
Sorry, those were the chants. Yeah. Those were the chants. I mean, their economic policies are all gaga. Like, you know, we understand the economics. Well, we understand a fair bit of economics. We've done a couple of centuries of science on it. Ignoring it all is not a particularly sensible approach, and they all did it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I almost was going to talk about it, but it's true. The others weren't... It's so much... I don't know how you get to a situation... I guess Trump is a symptom more than you know, the real issue. But the symptom is so... It sticks out like a sore something... And, but I guess at some point you can only vote so many times for people and hope that it's going to work until you throw everything up in the air and you're like, fine, whatever, you know, let's give the clown a chance and see what happens.
But I think that
right?
it's important to, and this relates to my experience of politics, of history of politics in Peru, is that at the end, it's also important to keep in mind that you're going to have this president for 5 years or whatever amount of years, and you really, really need to not go past the okay, he's a clown, we're going to laugh 5 years from now of what he did, but also it's the dangerous part of electing someone who is not competent or able to do whatever crazy idea he has in mind.
It wouldn't be the first in the history of the U.S. We did have George W. Bush.
Yes, it's
the
true.
Scary thing is.
Yeah, like, but even Trump, you know, Bush even compared to Bush, even compared, yeah, exactly, even compared to Bush. I mean, everyone's saying, "Oh, yeah, but you know, actually, he's a very intelligent person, and he knows this." And I'm not convinced at all that Trump is. I mean, he obviously is media savvy, but I don't think, you know, people were saying, "Oh, Bush, actually, he is intelligent." I don't know that that has to be the case. When you're saying...
No, but Bush was... The advantage of Bush had his father to rein him in. That's the difference.
Maybe.
Yeah, he was part of a... he was part of an elite, which meant that he was protected from himself because all of his father's smartest people were put around him. I mean, you know, the vice president's office kind of ran the country.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess if you make a whole country depend on one person, actually, and Trump, I think, is the kind of person that is able because of his charisma or his way of thinking to take a decision based on only what he thinks. At least that's the impression I have, that you have a very uncertain future for a country, and whether good or bad, uncertainty is never good because it can become very bad at some point.
Yeah,
you're just a very bad decision away from a crisis.
Well, he was asked whose advice would you take, and he said, "Well, I talk to myself."
No, I mean, there's no doubt that he is. He could be dangerous. I mean, you know what? Maybe it's going to turn out that he's going to surround himself with the smartest people, and he's going to heed their advice, and he's going to make bold decisions that are going to work out. Yes, maybe all of this is going to happen. But you know, there are with maybes.
Why take a chance?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a saying in French which says, "With maybes, you could put Paris in a bottle." Like, with theoreticals, you can do anything, basically. And yes, maybe things are going to be perfect with Trump, and President Trump will be looked upon for centuries as the savior of democracy, the modern world, and our way of life. Maybe. But it certainly doesn't look like that. He looks like an idiot.
Well,
in a suit.
Hitler was seen as the savior of Germany.
Yeah, well, okay, you just crossed the Godwin law. We started talking about Nazis. I think that is a sign that we should end this discussion. But yeah, it's a concern.
Well,
let's put it like that.
He did declare that it's going to be a workers' party right now.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if that happens. All right. Thank you so much, guys, for being on. Before we close the show, I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, the Podcast Awards have declared their the podcasts that have been selected, and the Felix Club is selected in Society and Culture in that category. And so I'm actually not necessarily going to encourage you guys to go vote for it, because the voting opens on May 29th, so just in a couple of days. But you can vote every day, and I don't understand that system. It's basically funneling your audience to go and vote every day for the thing. And I don't want to be the guy that says, "Oh, please go vote for me every day for however many weeks it's going to happen." But I'm very honored and happy to be part of the selection. We'll see what happens. Maybe some shenanigans are going to take place and things will happen. But it's a weird thing. But yeah, the Podcast Awards, if you feel like voting, of course, please go and do so. I would be happy. And it's at podcastawards.com. And the other thing is iTunes comment, as usual. I'm just saying from the U.S. has come to say that he or she loves the show. They say, "It's great. I'm learning a lot of things about everyday life in other countries, which regrettably was missing from my worldview," etc., etc. Thank you very much for the comment. If you wish to give us a hand, please go to your iTunes or any other podcast catalog and leave a few stars and a review. That would make me extremely happy, and it helps other people people discover the show. So if you enjoyed this one, you can do that. You can also go to Patreon, patreon.com/thePhileas Club, and support the show financially, which would make me even more happy because just like those dirty Americans, I love money. So if you could do that, that would be awesome as well. If you think the show is worth it, then patreon.com/thePhileas Club. And of course,
loving money makes you a dirty American?
No, I just love money like the dirty Americans do.
If that's true, then I'm the dirtiest American ever.
Well, I'm not going to say that it's a bad thing. So there you go. All right. Well, since you seem chatty, Turkey, why don't you tell people where they can find your web shenanigans?
You can find me on Twitter at Turkey Albella, TurkeyAlbella. I try to post from time to time, and you can find me here on the Phileas Club on occasions.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming back. Bart, where are you? What do you do on the internet?
Well, actually, I'm delighted to find that there is another monthly podcast, because I thought I was the only person who did monthly podcasts. So I do two monthly podcasts, one called Let's Talk Apple, where we get together at the end of the month, which is usually the first few days of the next month, and we talk about everything Apple newsworthy in the last month. So very similar idea to what we're doing here today, but all about Apple instead of about, you know, the world. And then Let's Talk Photography, which is sort of in the middle of the month, and it's all about the art and craft of photography, not about this camera versus that camera, or this lens versus that lens, or this software versus this other software. It's about, you know, the stuff that every photographer should be thinking about. It doesn't matter whether you use a camera phone or whether you use the world's most expensive camera. It's all photography, and that's what we want to talk about. So let's-talk.ie is where you'll find my stuff.
Excellent. And I'm going to let you say your Twitter name because I'm unable to pronounce this.
Okay, so we have the technical pronunciation for my surname is Buschutz, which is the Flemish pronunciation. But we have decided as a family that no one can say that in the English-speaking world. So we have opted for the alternative pronunciation of Buschutz. But it's Bravo Uniform Sierra Sierra Charlie Hotel Oscar Tango Sierra, which I say so often.
Excellent. That is an amazing way of saying it. So the Twitter name will be in the show notes, of course, and you can go through that to get to the podcast. So if you're interested, just do that. And of course, thank you very much, Franco, for representing the entirety of the Spanish-speaking world today on the show. I don't think you do have a presence on the internet, do you?
I think I have Google Plus. That's the only thing I have.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Which
laugh.
Is weird because no one has. I post things from time to time, but again, I do not have much more things than that. Yeah, so you can find me, I think, in Google Plus. I don't know if you search my name. I guess you find me. I do publish things publicly.
All right, so I'll leave your name in the show notes as well. So if people want to find you, if there are people still using Google Plus, there used to be a time where people would hunt me down for saying something like that. And I loved Google Plus when it first came out. But I think nowadays, most people, it's like Windows Phone. Most people are like, yeah, actually, it's probably kind of half dead. So
I think I like it because it's so quiet. I think it's nothing much happens, and I like it that way. So it's very easy, and I don't have to worry too much. I don't have to check it every day. It's for me, it suits very well.
Excellent. Well, there you go. You like it because it's quiet. That's the best description of Google Plus I've heard in a long time. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for being on the show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will be back next month. I don't think we're going to do a special episode next month, or maybe for a little while. We've done a bunch, but we will be back in a month for a regular show. That's for sure at the end of June. And until then, I hope you all have a wonderful month and that those of you who can enjoy the wonders of democracy at its best. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you in a month.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.